This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up today on Radio Boston, getting off the Esplanade and those big beaches and finding the secret summer getaways in and around Boston. That's coming up later on the program.
But first, we begin in Washington, where today a judge declared a mistrial in the Roger Clemens perjury case just one day after it began. The former Red Sox pitcher was accused of lying to Congress in 2008 about using performance-enhancing drugs. And joining us now from federal court in Washington is Shira Springer. She covers sports and society for the Boston Globe. And Shira, you were actually in the courtroom when Judge Reggie Walton declared a mistrial. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty shocking to all of us there. And basically what happened was the prosecution was going through its case and showing clips from the 2008 hearing where Roger Clemens said he did not use steroids or HGH. And as he was going through various clips, the judge abruptly stopped things at the mention of Laura Pettis and what she had heard from her husband. Because this violated a pretrial order from the judge barring testimony about or from Laura Pettis except in rebuttal.
And the judge had barred that because Laura Pettit hadn't spoken with Roger Clemens directly.
Exactly. And, you know, he stopped it in the courtroom today because he didn't want the testimony of one witness, this video, to bolster the credibility of Andy Pettit, who was going to be a key prosecution witness, the one person who had allegedly heard Roger Clemens say he had used human growth hormone.
And so, Shira, I understand that Judge Reggie Walton was quite incensed by the fact that the prosecution had played this tape, even after, as you said, he had told them not to. And this, in fact, was the second time that prosecution had gone against judges' orders, that they had even done something unacceptable in opening arguments as well.
Exactly, yes. The prosecution in opening arguments talked about two former Yankees, Chuck Knoblauch and Mike Stanton, using steroids. And the judge, you know, there was an objection raised, and the judge sort of stopped it there and reminded them, you know, that he didn't want guilt by association. He didn't want the jury to think that because Clemens' teammates used performance-enhancing drugs, that Clemens did as well. So this was violation number two, and, you know, you could just tell from the judge that he was sort of crestfallen when he had to declare this mistrial today.
And on the second day of the trial, boggles my mind that the prosecution did this. What was the reaction from other members in the courtroom?
Shock. I mean, it was sort of like, I can't believe this is happening, because, yes, it is the second day after opening statements, but you have to also remember that they'd spent, you know, the court had spent roughly 4 days selecting a jury. So, and this was expected to be a 4 to 6 week trial, and already, as the judge mentioned when he dismissed the jury, a lot of time and a lot of taxpayer money had been invested in this, and so literally just out of the box kind of fumbled them. It was completely shocking.
Shira, I understand that that Roger Clemens and his team, his legal team, are still under a gag order by the court and may not be able to speak to anyone directly about what happened today, but you also bumped into Clemens, didn't you, just a few hours ago? How did he at least seem?
Well, it was funny. I wouldn't say I bumped into him. What actually happened was literally a gaggle of reporters, cameramen, photographers followed Clemens and his attorney, Rusty Hardin, as they left the courthouse and walked to a nearby Aubon Path and for lunch. And basically, as he was leaving the courtroom, you know, no smile from Clemens. So Rusty Hardin said, you know, basically he was sorry he couldn't comment because of the gag order, but said it's a beautiful day. Roger Clemens said no comment, but it was interesting to note that as he was leaving the courtroom, two Red Sox fans approached Clemens and asked for him to autograph some baseballs, and he did.
Well, what's next for Roger Clemens then? I mean, is there a possible that there could be a continuance of this case, or is he in the free and clear?
Well, he's certainly a lot better to get now than he was when the day started. But what's going to happen is on September 2nd, they're going to have a hearing, and they're going to determine whether there should be a retrial.
Shira Springer reporting to us live today from federal court in Washington. She reports for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The case of alleged mobster Whitey Bulger is fascinating, sensational, and complex. And this week provided more evidence of all of the above. Today, U.S. Magistrate Judge Jennifer Bowl is wrestling with the decision whether or not to release Catherine Gregg on bail. Gregg is Whitey Bulger's longtime girlfriend who spent 16 years with him on the lam, and she's charged with harboring a fugitive. In court yesterday, Judge Bowl allowed the family members of Bulger's alleged victims to testify against Gregg to make the case why she shouldn't be released. It was an unusual move by Judge Bowl. And to talk about how unusual, we're joined now by Allison Burroughs, a partner at McNutter, McLennan and Fish in Boston. She's also a former assistant U.S. attorney in Boston and Philadelphia who prosecuted organized crime cases. And Allison, thanks for coming in.
You're more than welcome. It's nice to be here.
What did you make of Judge Bowl's decision?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that the victims wanted to speak at this stage of the proceedings. Judges don't usually wrestle with this because the victims don't want to be heard until sentencing, where they can say, put the person in jail forever or be lenient, whatever it is they want to say. In this case, the statute is interesting. It gives victims a right to speak. So that needs to be a victim of Catherine Gregg's alleged crime, not a victim of Whitey Bulger's crime, since it's Catherine Gregg's detention hearing. Mm. The crime she's alleged to commit is harboring. So first of all, do you really have a victim of harboring?
Right. She has to figure out whether or not these relatives even qualify as Catherine Gregg's victims. So my question is, isn't it strange to allow them to speak and then say she would figure out if they're victims? I mean, it seems like it ought to be done the other way around.
Well, the decision that Magistrate Judge Bowl is making is whether Catherine Gregg is a risk of flight or a danger to the community. Mm-hmm. So if these people have evidence that's relevant to either one of those two issues, then they should be allowed to speak and she should hear them. I think her point is that she can't make a determination about whether what they have to say is relevant to one of those two issues until they've said it.
I see. Well, I want to read a passage from today's Boston Globe about this. It went like this. Thomas Donahue, whose father, Michael Donahue, was gunned down in 1982, had to stop several times to calm his rage and grief. Quote, while she was there tinting her hair, we laid awake at night sweating from the nightmares and shedding tears. If you let her out of here to go live with her father, it's a complete slap to the victims of Whitey Bulger. So can there even be a fair trial with that kind of emotion in the courtroom so soon in the proceedings?
Well, I'm sure that her defense attorneys are wrestling with the pros and cons of moving for a change of venue. You can move for a change of venue if you can make the case that a defendant can't get a fair trial in Massachusetts. Mm. It's an interesting weighing of different things, I think, because every time these victims speak, they're helping build the defense's case that they can't get a fair trial here. So the defense may well have decided to let that play out and just see how prejudicial it gets to be. And then when it's time to move for that change of venue, they can say they testified here, they testified there, they testified here. There can't be a juror in the greater Boston area that can be fair.
Hmm. Interesting. What else struck you about yesterday's proceeding?
It was also interesting to me, I think, that the government was advocating in favor of allowing these victims to speak. And the statute does require that the government do what it can to make sure that victims get their rights, which is the right to be reasonably heard. But because of the potential prejudice that the victims testifying can cause, I was interested that the government was sort of so aggressive in trying to get them heard. That decision might be a little short-sighted.
Mm. Now, we still don't know if Catherine Gregg will stay behind bars. As we mentioned, Judge Bowl needs to consider that. What does she have to take into account?
The two things that she is supposed to consider is whether or not the defendant is a risk of flight or a danger to the community. In this case, I think the danger to the community argument is a tough one to make. So I think this is all about risk of flight. And the question is she a risk of flight? On the one hand, electronic monitoring is pretty good. On the other hand, she has a demonstrated ability to live as a fugitive. I think that everyone's sort of supposition is that she knows where the cash is and has access to it. So I basically think it comes down to a risk of flight assessment.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming in and helping to explain this to us. We appreciate it.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Allison Burroughs is a partner at Nutter, McLennan and Fish in Boston. She was also a former assistant U.S. attorney in Boston and Philadelphia.
Up next, lesser-known ideas for summer fun around Boston. From a castle in Gloucester built by the father of the remote control to a model train set in the woods around Needham,
that you can only find by GPS. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.